Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. The president is going to make it easier to get more ethanol into the gasoline. And to tell us what that means, here is car specialist, the host of the Car Chronicles, Jeff Gilbert from WWJ in Detroit. What's going on here, Jeff?
Well, what's going on here is the president is going to officially announce later today that ethanol blends of gasoline, and this is not all gasoline, it's just that which has ethanol blends in it, can go from 10% to 15% in the summer. There had been a regulation that kept it down to 10% during the warmer months out of fear that it would pollute more.
It does pollute more, doesn't it? Wasn't this one of the big ironies of environmentalism that ethanol, which was supposed to be this renewable fuel, actually creates more air pollution than just regular gas?
Apparently, there are differing opinions on that. Of course, the different opinions depend on whether you're with the petroleum industry or the agriculture industry. Isn't that interesting?
Yes. Well, we are almost self-sufficient with gasoline now. So what's the reason for boosting ethanol in the gas?
I think from what I'm reading, one of the larger reasons is for farmers. A lot of farmers have invested a lot in the crops that make ethanol, and this is seen as giving a little bit of a boost to farmers, some of whom have been hurt by the trade difficulties with China. So this is something that apparently the president thinks is going to play very well in the agricultural part of the countries. But areas like Seattle, for example, which are more environmentally sensitive, he's going to get more criticism, but there's a surprise. He gets criticism in cities like Seattle every day.
Well, yeah. I was surprised to read that 40% of the U.S. corn crop isn't going into corn for your table. It's going into your gas tank.
Well, you know, that's been a major issue with the auto industry for years. Back a decade ago when gas prices were at $4 a gallon, ethanol was like the big thing. You know, we don't have enough gasoline. We have to make more ethanol. And they were looking at ways to make ethanol without corn. I remember the cellulosic ethanol was the big buzzword in the auto industry, making it out of a kind of grass. But of course, when gasoline prices started going away, then the stimulus to make more ethanol went away as well.
Okay, so settle the argument. Is it good for your engine or not?
That's another question that it depends on who you talk to. There are some mechanics who say it is not good for your engine. There are others who say it's okay. The car companies have said that that vehicles are generally in good shape with smaller amounts of ethanol, and they, a few years ago, made some engines that would take 85% ethanol in gasoline. So it depends on your vehicle, but the general consensus is in small amounts, it's okay, but, you know, I'm not a mechanic, so don't quote me on that.
Okay, but in other words, it's every car on the road today is made to tolerate a certain level of ethanol, correct?
Yeah, every car that's built today. I mean, I'm sure some older cars that are on the road probably won't tolerate it. But yeah, the auto industry makes it to tolerate 10 to 15% ethanol.
By the way, as long as I've got you, tell me about the next wave of electric cars, because that would settle this whole ethanol thing once and for all. I know that Tesla's kind of on the ropes, but aren't everybody's in the electric car business now, aren't they?
Exactly. And I was just at the Paris Auto Show. How's that for name dropping? Yes. And there were a ton of electric vehicles unveiled there, and many from high-end car makers like Mercedes and Audi, and Jaguar is now about to send its I-Pace to the U.S. So Tesla is going to have a lot of competition with some really high-end electric vehicles that also happen to be crossovers, which is what Americans are buying, car-based SUVs.
Yeah, and they'll actually perform better than their gas counterparts from what I hear.
I mean, you can make an electric vehicle. I mean, you can make a race car out of an electric vehicle. It has instant acceleration, so it's just like a gasoline vehicle. However powerful you want to make that motor is, the vehicle is going to be that powerful. But the difference is, the second you put your foot on the accelerator on an electric vehicle, there is no lag. That's goes.
Right.
My neck was punished one time driving one.
I did. For a week, I was driving around in one of those Teslas and, you know, accelerating to 60 miles an hour. And what was it? 2.5 seconds? Like a rocket ship.
Ludicrous mode is what they call it. And that essentially is the electric equivalent of what Dodge has in its Hellcat engines. It just doesn't have the zoom, zoom sound to it.
Ludicrous mode. That sounds safe. Jeff Gilbert from the Car Chronicles, WWJ in Detroit. Jeff, thanks very much.
Thanks for the call, Dave.
Choke points. Let's go. Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. I-5 through Chehalis is going to be closed for 60 hours. When and why?
Not I-5. It's the overpass.
The overpass.
And all the roads around that overpass in Chehalis have a 60-hour closure starting up next week. And the reason is it's been about 2 years or more than 2 years now since an oversized load smacked the Chamberway overpass on southbound I-5, ripping out concrete, damaging several girders. The southbound span of that overpass had to come down to prevent a possible collapse, which cut off the primary route from the east side of I-5 to the shopping district over on the west. Like we saw with the expedited repairs on the Skagit River Bridge after its collapse, the legislature sped up funding to get on this Chamberway problem quickly. A temporary span was put in, and work to replace the old overpass got started right away in about a year, which is pretty fast going through the Washington process. That new overpass is now finished, and all that's left is to tie in the roadway on either side. Frank Green is with the Washington Department of Transportation. He says the old overpass was only two lanes, so they not only rebuilt a new one, they rebuilt a bigger one, double that.
The new bridge would have, the width to have four lanes across it, as well as a bicycle and pedestrian sidewalk. And it's also higher, so it'll have more vertical clearance over the freeway, help avoid a future oversized load from hitting it.
Starting Monday, that tie-in work is going to begin with Chamberway being closed for 60 hours. Green says the original plan was for a series of closures, but this seemed like a better idea.
It was kind of to move one lane at a time onto the new bridge, and so they would have had to have done that over a series of closures that would have taken, 2 to 3 weeks long of duration until they could get all traffic moved onto the new bridge, which would start getting us into that that time frame of maybe impacting the upcoming holiday season.
And since some of the larger stores rely on that Chamberway overpass, the decision was made to rip off the Band-Aid and speed up that schedule.
It's a schedule-driven closure that we're looking to do, try to get all traffic moved onto the new bridge at once so that you don't have some traffic on the detour bridge, some traffic on the new bridge, and then have that condition changing over the next 3 or so weeks.
Frank says the only X factor left in all of this is the weather.
If we see a lot of rain in those closure periods when they're scheduled to be doing the paving work or the striping work, we may have to shift the closure or have the contractor rethink how they could achieve that work.
If the weather holds, the forecast currently looking pretty decent for that. The closure is going to begin at 7 p.m. on Monday and then wrap up at 7 a.m. on Thursday, and we'll get a brand new overpass there, and everything should be buttoned up, and hopefully we'll stop having oversized loads hit our bridges and overpasses.
So to be clear, I-5 itself is not affected?
No, because all the I-5 closures that they've had to deal with when they were putting in the span and working on stuff overhead, that's all been taken care of. This is kind of like the viaduct situation when we have to tie in the new tunnel to the roads around.
They're linking all the
what they're doing is they're cutting off that east-west access across the freeway for 60 hours, which is pretty significant for the folks there in Chehalis. There's a big shopping, like a bunch of box stores on the west side of the freeway, the Walmart there, Home Depot, there's a bunch of different shopping places there, and so they want to get that open as soon as possible.
And is there some kind of oversized height alarm going to be installed, or, do they figure out how did the oversized truck get on the highway in the first place?
That where they're trying to figure out. I'm going to go back and take a look and see what they've kind of found out of that. But there are pictures up at mynorthwest.com because it was like a large dump truck that might have been, and it just probably shouldn't have been there because that was a low height bridge kind of to begin with, and it ripped up the bottom of that thing pretty significantly.
Yeah, it would seem the cost of a little laser beam across the highway is a lot less than especially the replacing a whole span.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is a much higher bridge as well. So hopefully we should be able to have that
higher.
Buttoned up as well.
Do you remember the story from last year where a woman accused one Bellevue police officer of an assault and then accused another of raping her? And now we're learning the story is very different, that she, in fact, has a history of making false accusations. Kyrie's Hannah Scott is here to track down this story. Now, an officer lost his job over this, right?
He ended up resigning, I believe in August because of this. So this all started late last year. A married woman from Issaquah met married Bellevue Detective John Kivlin on Craigslist. They started an affair that lasted about 7 months until this April. Now, early in April, the two were talking about leaving their spouses, though, starting a life together while simultaneously fighting and breaking up. She twice claimed that he beat her up and also filed a complaint saying that he'd used a police computer to run her plates to find out where she lived with her husband. Kivlin was arrested then the first time and charged with assault. Investigators did find that he had actually used that police computer to run his plates. There was a lot of drama between the two, between April and May, and the woman called a crisis hotline at some point saying that she was going to harass Kivlin until he shot her. Cops found her that night driving around with a gun, and she was involuntarily committed for 3 days. Both ended up getting no contact orders against one another just before the summer this year. And then in July, the woman went to the cops saying Kivlin had violated that order by texting her several times and saying things like he needed to see her one last time, encouraging her to change her story with the police and say it was all a misunderstanding. Then in August, she again reported that Kivlin had violated the no contact order by texting her more than a dozen times. He was rearrested, held for days on a large bond, and new charges of violating a no contact order and witness tampering were added. But now that's the key one. In August, when the sheriff's investigators did a search of hers and Kivlin's phones, they found that the latest accusations from August were all a sophisticated ruse, is the way they described it. Basically, that she got Kivlin to text her by pretending to be someone else and fabricating evidence. Now, those charges were dismissed last month, and yesterday, prosecutors tossed the entire case against him, witness tampering, domestic violence, because she's not a credible witness anymore because of the fact that she fabricated evidence and had the sophisticated ruse related to the August charges, but also because they found that in 2009-2010, she had falsely accused other officers of rape and later admitted to lying about that. Now, during all of this stuff with Kivlin, she also accused another Bellevue officer of rape. That charges were never even filed in that. So both of those cases are now gone.
Wow. So now these incidents never happened, or were these consensual encounters that she characterized as rape? Or
I believe in the one that the current Bellevue officer she accused of rape, it sounds like that was a consensual thing. Again, no charges ever there. It does sound like Detective Kivlin, the investigation did show he used the police computers and also that he was maybe guilty of witness tampering and one set of text messages from July suggesting that he contacted her when there was the no contact order. Now, all of this, so all said and done, he is now resigned. He's out of his job. He spent, I believe, almost 50 days behind bars through all of this, having been arrested multiple times. But the case against him, the criminal case, is now gone because she no longer has credibility. This is the same woman in all of these cases, and also the same woman tied to the investigation against Bellevue Police Chief Steve Milette. That is being handled by Bothell Police. Now, Bothell Police have never said exactly what the allegations are against the Bellevue Police Chief. He's been on leave since August because of them. But I know that it's involving the same woman. I know in the investigation into Kivlin, there are text messages where that woman suggests that she had sex with the Bellevue Police Chief. Yes. He has told me that is not the case and that he didn't know her. The only reason that he knew of her was because of the investigation into one of his detectives. Now, I spoke to Chief Milette yesterday. He has been very careful not to speak too much about this. He said he will comment when he can more freely speak about it, which he hopes will be soon. Now, I also talked to Bothell Police yesterday. They tell me that while that is still an active investigation into Chief Milette, they have so far found no corroborating evidence to support the claims. Hmm.
So the lesson here is stay away from the personals on Craigslist?
Yeah, probably. I want to point out no charges, or I should say the King County Sheriff's Department, which handled most of this investigation regarding Kivlin, is not recommending charges against this woman for false reporting.
Why not?
Because they have mental health concerns for her.
I see. She'll get treatment now?
We'll see. We'll see.
Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Kyrie is Hannah Scott. Our Sports Insider is brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. And now here he is from 710 ESPN Seattle, that 24-hour geyser of sports, Danny O'Neill. The Huskies head down to Eugene for the big showdown with the Ducks. And that usually means that there's going to be trouble between Chris Sullivan, who is an Oregonian, and Danny O'Neill, who is a Huskatonian. So who is going to win?
The way the Huskies played last week, I'm not all that optimistic. They didn't look good in UCLA.
Really?
No, they didn't play very well at all. Their defense got cut up.
I thought in the Pac-12 they were number one.
They're considered the top team,
and
they're ranked
number two. The Ducks are like number what, 17? What are they?
No, the Ducks just imploded in one game against Stanford, but it's been their only loss, which by the way was by far my favorite thing that's happened in sports this year. watching the Ducks absolutely blow and melt down. In fact, I think I can frustrate Chris Sullivan by just going like this.
Well, didn't they lose like
it happened
70 to something?
Ooh.
2 years
ago?
That
was 2 years ago, yeah.
2 years ago. 70 points scored against them. Isn't that a record for points scored against any team ever?
No, but no. It was pretty satisfying, I'll tell you that.
Well, considering they'd lost a dozen straight to Oregon before that, they had to exercise some demons, though. And I think in all of those 12 losses, Washington wasn't within three touchdowns in that 12-straight year stretch, yeah.
Here's the thing, is that Oregon likes to live in the past and sit there
bask
upon their
glory.
Oh, really?
We're talking about that national championship, the co-national championship from 91. I haven't heard about that from Washington living in the past. Really?
Yeah.
Come on, man.
Half is greater than zero.
Yeah, but who's ever been to a playoff championship game?
Well, we went to the national college
football
national
playoff game. You didn't go to the championship
game.
Or nor have you won a Heisman.
That's all true. That's all true. But see, again, we're bringing up past accomplishments instead of this match. Yeah,
just like yours.
You want to live in the present, don't you?
Yeah. That's why Saturday should be fun.
I had the good sense to leave the state at the age of 15 and leave and burn rubber on my way out and never come back. And I think that everyone in the conference, if you ask everyone, the Cougars are our rival, but they're really more like the little brother.
Right.
Like
by default,
we generally kind of like the Cougs.
Right.
We absolutely loathe the Oregon.
Where does
Ducks.
That? Can you? They're I missed Beverly, this in the Huskies 101 rivalries when I was at UW. Where did this come from? This
in 1994. Kenny Wheaton stepped in a big old pile of Lucky Poo on his way to intercepting a pass from Damon Heward. He returned it for a touchdown. And at that moment in 1994, when the Oregon Ducks still had a Disney character plastered on the side of their Mickey Mouse helmets, they suddenly vaulted into significance. They lucked their way to a Rose Bowl, got trounced by Penn State in that Rose Bowl. Their quarterback that year is named Danny O'Neill.
What?
Yeah. His name's Danny O'Neill. And every year, sometimes about this time, I'll get an email from someone thinking I'm that Danny O'Neill.
So it wasn't you.
And it takes me every bit of professional restraint not to respond to that person by saying, you know what, I really hate the University of Oregon and I wish they disbanded their entire athletic department.
Now for an alternate view of that same play. Not only did Kenny Wheaton make an incredible play, the Oregon didn't luck into anything. Washington was stupid. They had the best running back in the nation, and they didn't run the ball from the 3-yard line for what would have been an easy touchdown. That's coaching. That's Damon's worst pass ever. Now, if you want a real look at why Oregon treats Washington the way it does, I grew up down going to those games through the 70s when we would just get the living dog beaten out. I mean, it wasn't even close. And the little old ladies in their fancy sweatshirts and their RVs would come down and talk down to everybody in Eugene, and then they'd roll up I-5 like they own the place, which they did. And so when it finally came time to turn the tables, Oregon got really uppity really fast and got in the faces for 30 years worth of beatdowns. And that's what fueled that. And then Oregon managed to go on a little winning streak. And that's why things got really nasty, is because Oregon threw it back in Washington's face. No one had ever done that to Washington before, and they didn't like it. Mm. And so that's why it got that way.
The Oregon Ducks are the Beverly Hillbillies of the Pac-12. They stumbled into Uncle Phil Knight's money, instead of finding Texas tea bubbling up like a boiling crude, like it was Nike money that's fueled them, and they've they've all of a sudden become this nouveau riche. Like,
that is also true.
And the thing is, you can't buy class. You can't buy class. So when Oregon loses in dramatic fashion to Stanford, you see some drunk hillbilly at the side of the tunnel sitting there trying to fight Stanford players as he comes off, while the Oregon fans rain bottles down.
All right, that's enough.
Though we will talk about the time my son was assaulted at a Husky game by drunk Washington fans.
All right.
And he was six.
I thought it was the little old lady in sweaters.
No, that was this is real time. That was back in the 70s when I was 6 years old.
I think that's the headline, is what does Sully have against little old ladies in sweaters?
No, because they talked down to us.
Anybody realize that Cornell won the Ivy League men's lacrosse title last spring?
And Glee Club saying. Went to state?
Yeah.
And that architecture program is through the roof.
Yeah, seriously. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
It's going to be a great week, isn't it?
Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Joining us now live from the Washington Post, Pulitzer Prize winner David Farenthold. Were you expecting Nikki Haley to resign as UN ambassador? And is this really just because she needs a break, David?
I was not expecting it, and whatever politicians say when they're resigning is always never—it's obviously never the real answer. I don't know what the right answer is in this case. We've had some reporting showing that her clout had diminished a little bit. She was very powerful under Rex Tillerson, who was such a weak Secretary of State. Pompeo, the current Secretary of State, is a lot stronger, so her role had been diminished. Who knows? She obviously has further political ambitions. Maybe this is part of that.
Oh. Well, that would make sense. I can see when your boss changes, then sometimes your role no longer becomes as satisfying. Anyway, it seemed like an amicable separation. So, on the Rod Rosenstein front, they met on the plane. He came back happy. Is that the end of this?
It seems like that's the end of it for now. I mean, I think a lot of people expect that President Trump will get rid of Attorney General Jeff Sessions after the midterms, whether Democrats take any chamber of Congress or not. And whoever he replaces Sessions with could put some more strictures on Rosenstein. Whoever he replaces Sessions with wouldn't be recused, probably, from the Russia investigation. So Rosenstein's job could change after that. But I think the chances of him firing Rosenstein, which seemed on the table a couple of weeks ago, are pretty low now.
Right. And in terms of the elections, the polling for a while was showing an easy Democratic takeover of the House. Since the Kavanaugh confirmation, some of that polling has changed. So, based on what your colleagues are doing at the Washington Post, there is it looking like the Democrats are locked to take the House or not?
No, definitely not. I think the Kavanaugh, it's still early to know what the overall effect of the Kavanaugh hearings will be, but it seems like the short-term effect was to energize Republicans, particularly in some of the battleground Senate races, some of the races like North Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, where Democrats seem to have a chance. There's a Democratic incumbent in North Dakota, obviously. Republicans really surged in those places during the Kavanaugh, the sort of week of FBI investigation of Kavanaugh. You know, whether that is still a dominant factor on Election Day, it's hard to know. Obviously, we have a circus every day here, so yeah. I don't know if people will still be thinking about Brett Kavanaugh in November.
I mean, clearly some Democrats calculated that to make a big issue of this was going to help them, and I don't think it did. Do you?
I think you're right that they thought it would. I haven't seen really any evidence so far that it has helped them. With polling that's come out during the week before Kavanaugh was confirmed and since he was confirmed shows Democrats are still a favor to take the House. But, you know, I look at 538 all the time where they try to put a number on the chances that Democrats will take the House, and it's gone down from like 82% down to 73%, I think, in that time. So it doesn't seem like it's helped Democrats at all.
Yeah. Now to your own crusade, which is to bring some transparency to Donald Trump's finances. You've got another long piece talking about you're sort of piggybacking on the New York Times article about his past finances and how he kept going back to daddy to bankroll his projects. You've tried to find out more about his recent finances. And so what have you concluded?
Well, so you're right to point out that great New York Times story from last week showed that basically up until 2004, when Trump sells his father's estate, father died in 1999, that his father's money had been the lifeline that kept Trump Org alive. The president's companies would often take big risks and fail or need big infusions of cash, and his father's company, which was very not flashy, had a bunch of small apartment buildings in Brooklyn, but produced a ton of cash, his father's businesses bailed him out. So we've tried to look at what's happened since 2004, when that lifeline from his father was gone. How did the president's finances change? And I can't see what's behind the curtain, but I can see a few things that are really unusual in that period. One, he started buying a lot of things in straight cash. You know, he'd previously never bought anything without a loan. He started buying golf courses and some really big golf courses and resorts with cash only, no public loans. And also, he turned to a part of Deutsche Bank that doesn't usually provide financing for large commercial projects. He turned to the private wealth management side of Deutsche Bank, where basically they give loans to rich people to buy second homes and things like that. He got them to give him loans for like $170 million to buy a hotel in D.C. So we don't really understand those switches, but they're certainly new and different after his father's lifeline was cut off.
So you're sniffing at something here. Can you tell us what it is?
I don't really know what it is yet. It's certainly the cash purchases, the explanation we've been given by the Trumps about why they had so much money to buy things in cash, and that's really unusual for real estate. Yeah. It's too risky. There's tax losses involved in it. Most people don't buy giant pieces of real estate with just cash. They use loans. That's how the business works. Yeah. Trump defied that and defied his own history, started buying things in cash. And when we ask them why, the Trumps say, well, our businesses throw off so much cash our golf courses and hotels produce so much cash every day that we just, you know, we're just swimming in cash. And so it was nothing for us to dip a little bit out and buy a, you know, $60 million golf course. People that know those businesses, the golf course business and the hotel business, say that's truly implausible. Those are not, you know, businesses that generate a huge amount of cash. But I don't have any other alternative explanation yet.
So you're looking for the source of the cash, aren't you?
Exactly.
Okay. To be continued. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Washington Post reporter David Farenthold. Seattle voters are going to be asked to approve something called Prop 1 next month. It's a more than $600 million education levy. It covers multiple programs in the city, including subsidized preschool. Kyria's Hannah Scott has been diving into this, and she has the latest report card on the pre-K program, what you should know about this levy. So how is this report card set up?
So this is an annual review. The subsidized preschool program was approved as a four-year pilot, $58 million a year back in 2014, with the goal of eventually getting every kid in the city, regardless of income level, access to early learning. Every year they do this annual review. Gail Joseph with the UW's College of Education says the latest annual review of the pre-K program is showing great results.
We measure children's skills in the fall and the spring of the year with direct child assessment in the areas of receptive vocabulary, so understanding words, their early literacy, their early math, and executive functioning skills. And children in the Seattle preschool program made gains in every domain measured. And those gains in literacy, language, and math are larger than you would expect from just maturation or age alone, which is good news.
And she says while there were gains in math, they were not quite as substantial as the prior year's review, so there's some work to be done in that area. Overall, though, Mayor Jenny Durkin is thrilled with the results.
Our investment in pre-K is helping families be healthier throughout Seattle, and it's an investment in our workforce development. Most importantly, it's an investment in the opportunity for our kids and for their families. As the evaluation says, the Seattle preschool program's quality now exceeds in some major city and state pre-K programs. It's on par with the widely recognized New York City and San Antonio programs.
Former mayor and city council member Tim Burgess, among those who led the initial effort for this pre-K program back in 2014, says it's vital that it keeps going.
The results of this independent and objective evaluation make it very clear that we are ready to close the opportunity gap that has held back so many of our kids from lower income families and communities of color.
Okay, so this is to make sure everybody is at the same level when they get to kindergarten.
Right, so it's over the major effort here to close what's known as the opportunity or the achievement gap, whether it's low-income, communities of color, things of that nature. The city wants to extend and expand this program to more than double the number of kids in it to 2,500 by the year 2026. But to even keep it going, voters are going to have to approve Prop 1 next month. This is the largest ever property tax levy for education in the city. Now, the current levy that pays for the preschool program is set to expire at the end of this year, as is the family's education levy. Now, that pays for K through 12 programs like family support, after-school programs, and school-based health centers, things of that nature. So both of those are set to expire at the end of this year. Prop 1 combines those two expiring levies and also includes money to launch the mayor's Promise program, which covers 2 years of free community college, or the equivalent, for all Seattle high school graduates, eventually, but it would start with this levy. Mm-hmm. Now, the combined seven-year levy for all three of those programs would bring in close to $620 million and cost the average homeowner $242 a year, or $20 a month. That's about $9 more a month than they were already paying under those two expiring levies. A great investment, according to Mayor Durkin. But when I asked her, there's a lot of tax fatigue, right? Some of the city council members voted to repeal the head tax because there was concerns this levy would not pass because of so much tax fatigue. So Mayor Durkin, when I asked her about the concerns about tax fatigue, she solidly said that this is just a great investment.
We look at the range of things and opportunities and challenges we have in Seattle. Our homelessness programs, foster care, the criminal justice system, those things are feeding it. Disproportionately people of color, and disproportionately people who did not have educational opportunities. So if we are able to pivot and continue to support these great programs that we know work, give our kids that start, we will see that Seattle becomes a better city. I think it is one of the most important things any of us can do for opportunity for Seattle and its children.
Any polling on this?
I've not seen any polling. There's no one registered really against it. I think the League of Women Voters, for some reason, had some issues with the levy. I'm not clear on what that was about. But otherwise, there's no like opposition campaign running anything against
this. This is not on top of the levy that's there. This replaces it.
It replaces it, increases it slightly because, again, the pre-K program they're hoping to expand. And then we've got that College Promise in there. So it's a very large levy, but, you know, it's about closing that opportunity gap. And what she seems to suggest there in that last cut is that can help address giving everybody this opportunity as they grow older can help, you know, keep homeless people off of our streets, deal with crime issues, things of that nature. So that's the long-term vision behind this. But at the same time, right, everybody's dealing with higher property taxes already because of SD3, because of the McCleary funding situation. And separately, next year, Seattle voters will also be asked to approve different levies because the school district will need their operations capital budget levy to be redone as well.
Wow.
So there's that. But now you know what Prop 1 is when you see it on the ballot, Seattle voters.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.